nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Anand, for your kind invitation and also introduction. Okay. Well, it's my pleasure to visit Purdue. I've, of course, heard of Purdue for many years. It has always been the center of semiconductor physics research. So although it's my first time visiting Purdue, is as they say, it's better late than never. Well, today, of course, it's special now that with the cameras focusing on me, I kind of feel like I'm on maybe a David Leno or Jane Leno and David Letterman show. Okay. My colleague Marvin Cohen once pointed out, he said, in the United States, we are supposed to start the talk with a joke. And in Japan, you have to start with an apology. So this is my first joke, okay. My second joke with the camera on, it reminds me that at one time there was this legendary conference in Brazil organized by fellow Raman scatterers Sergio Porto and Rogério Leite. And at that time, they were able to convince the Brazilian government to invest a lot of money in this new institute to make it the Bell Lab of the Southern America. And so they were able to pay for everyone's expense to go down to Brazil to attend this conference. And even graduate students get all their expenses paid. And Leo Felikov was invited to give the opening plenary talk. And of course, it was supposed to show for the whole country. So they have local television cameras and so on, focusing on Leo. And then Leo Felikov said, in view of the camera, I have to write something on the blackboard for the camera. So he wrote down this equation on the blackboard. So in view of the camera, I felt maybe I'll write down also some equation on the blackboard for the audience. So, okay, now the joke's over. Let's start talking about physics. Okay, maybe also I need to explain a little bit about this title. Of course, I'm going to talk about why we need semiconductor radiation detector. But you notice the subtlety of this title in that I said in search of the perfect semiconductor radiation detector. Actually, at first I was thinking of the title Finding This Perfect Semiconductor Radiation Detector, like in the movie Finding Nemo. But then I remember Finding Nemo has a happy ending, whereas this we haven't reached the happy ending that you'll find in this movie. So I decided to change the name to In Search of This Perfect Semiconductor Radiation Detector, just like in search of a parking space at the Berkeley campus. You know, David Nolte will appreciate this joke. Okay. All right, so let's look at the outline. So this is what I hope to tell you. It will consist of two parts. Both I tell you something about the experimental work and about the theoretical modeling. The reason why I can talk about both is because I used to be an experimentalist, spent most of my career in doing experiment, and recently I decided to switch to do theory. So I'm a born-again theorist. So I can also talk a little bit about our theoretical work. Okay. Now comes to the motivation. Why on Earth a solid-state physicist would be interested in nuclear radiation detectors? Well, there's a lot of money in it. So what I want to impart to you is after you're done with this talk, you feel enriched by this talk, okay? So the first slide that shows the richness, and that is there's a lot of money now floating around in Washington to give to anyone who can find the perfect detector. of things like dirty bombs. Okay, and you can see that if you can solve this problem, it's going to have a major impact on everyone's life, because in the future, when you go through the airport, in addition to just looking for metal, they're going to see whether you have some dirty bombs with you. So let's look at what is available today. Okay, well, of course, detectors of nuclear radiation have a very long history, as long as nuclear physics itself, or you can say even as long as quantum mechanics itself. You can always use the good old Geiger counter, but it has no energy resolution. And there's also the scintillators like sodium iodide doped with some impurities. And it has also a poor energy resolution. So the best detector, solid-state detector, is really semiconductor detectors based on ultra-pure germanium or silicon-dripped silicon. So David Noltier will also again know the history of this, since he used to work for Eugene Haller, who, of course, is the world authority on the growth of this ultra-pure germanium for nuclear radiation detector. It has high sensitivity, good energy resolution. The only problem is that it has to be cool to cryogenic temperature, typically liquid nitrogen temperature. So once you realize that, you say, all right, so really the big problem is that we need to find something that will operate at room temperature. So that will usually mean that you will have to get a bigger band gap. Things like silicon germanium have a too small band gap. Something like close to 2 eV will be ideal. Then it will work at room temperature. And then you said, well, you want to maintain the good energy resolution. So that's what you have in silicon germanium. The energy resolution has something to do with the band gap. So the band gap is small, then the resolution is better. And then in this case, you say, well, how does it work? What the way it works is then you basically send a high energy particle through your semiconductor. It will generate a burst of electron hole pairs. And so what you do is you apply an electric field. Apply electric field which separates the electron and hole, you generate a current. But in this case, as I will show you later, the absorption of most solid of this kind of high energy radiation, the absorption cross-section is rather small. And so you need a rather big crystal in order to give you a significant absorption. And as a result, what you find is that the carriers that you generate has to travel macroscopic distance to be collected, typically of the order of centimeters. So in this case, you find that you need something called a large mu tau product, where mu is mobility and tau is the lifetime. Lifetime comes in because you create an electron and hole. Like if you hit the sample with gamma ray, which is, of course, neutral, then it will generate equal amount of electrons and holes, and then the electron and holes, of course, attract each other and they would like to recombine, and then you lose your current. So in this case, you want them to stick around long enough to be collected. So these are the constraints you have to work with. Okay, so now I show you the absorption coefficient of, say, germanium for photon. So this graph is a little bit different what you find in most solid-state physics textbooks. The difference is the photon energy here is in keV. So when it says 1, then it means 1 keV. So it goes all the way to 10 million electron volt. Okay, so this is really in the realm of high energy physics. And what you find is that the absorption coefficient for most solids basically continue to decrease. Okay. And here you see certain steps. Those steps are corresponding to absorption due to excitation of core electrons. For example, this is the K electron exciting into the above the conduction band. And as you keep on going to high energy, you can see that the absorption cross-section continues to decrease. So in the region where you are talking about hard X-ray gamma rays, you are talking about absorption coefficient of 1 reciprocal centimeter, which means that if you have a sample which is 1 centimeter thick, the absorption probability is roughly 1/2. And so that's why most of the solid-state detectors, they are typically about that big, okay? Well, in case of ultra pure germanium, then the actual process works somewhat in this way. You basically have this high energy electron coming in, it excites some electron from the core state, you create something called core hole, and you create an electron with something of the order of maybe a million electron volt of kinetic energy. And then this very highly excited electron and hole will then go through something I call a cascade relaxation, in which it basically excites more electron and holes across the band gap. So this is, you may call it as some sort of an avalanche effect. So finally, you find that to create every electron hole pair, it requires something of the order of 5 electron volt. Okay. In this case, the energy is not exactly near the band gap, mainly because around the band gap, your density of states is very small. So what you do is you have to look at the entire band structure and ask where is the peak of the density of states for the conduction band and for the valence band. And then what you find is that typically this energy is of the order of 5 electron volt. Okay. But if your band gap is something like 2 eV, then you can see that you'll make a very minor error if you assume it to be equal to band gap. The bottom line is that you take 1 million electron volt divided by something like 5 eV, you are going to create many, many electron hole pairs, okay? And then electron hole pairs kind of cool down a little bit, they go down to the band minimum, and then you apply the electric field, which will then collect your current. And then, of course, in this collection process, you can see that the mobility comes in, and also the lifetime of the electron hole pair comes in. Yes?
What's the amount of energy which is generates electron hole pairs versus the phonons?
Well, you'll find that the high energy electron doesn't interact very strongly with the phonons. During the relaxation, actually there is phonon created when you go from this 5 eV down to, let's say, the band gap is 1 eV. So that 4 eV is lost in terms of heating up the lattice. That's where the electron phonon interaction comes in. Of course, ultimately, everything becomes heat, right? Because even when the electron hole pair recombines, some of it may come out as photons, but a lot of it basically comes out as heat. Yeah. Yes, another question. That's right. So actually what happened here is what you need is the lifetime of the electron hole pair. In other words, both of them, what you're going to look at is not just the lifetime of the electron or the lifetime of the hole, but rather the time when you have both electrons and holes together. So you may say that it is determined by the shorter of the two. Okay. Okay, so this basically tells you what is known in solid-state physics already, that if you want to calculate the mobility, you need to know the band structure, because that will tell you what's the effective mass. The mobility is inversely proportional to the effective mass. And of course, if you have a pure intrinsic material, the electron phonon scattering determines the mobility. But on the other hand, if you have a lot of defects, the defects can also affect the mobility. And this, in case of the lifetime, you have seen that the electron hole pair can recombine either radiatively or non-radiatively. And quite often, the non-radiative can dominate if you have defects which traps the electron or the hole. And in this sense, we find that indirect band gaps are good, because in this case, radiative recombination is strongly suppressed, because in this case, in order for the electron and the hole to recombine, they have to conserve wave vector and they need to involve a phonon. So both silicon and germanium, as you notice, are indirect band gap semiconductors. And that's the reason why they have a high mu tau product. Okay. So next one shows you a survey of the sort of state of the art of this kind of semiconductor new detector. This is some review article published in 2004. This is new in the Journal of Nuclear Instruments and Methods. Okay. And in this case, I have highlighted two particular semiconductors. You have silicon and you have germanium. The only other sort of a competitor on the horizon is cadmium telluride. Okay. Now, another thing I have not pointed out is that to enhance the absorption cross-section, you would like the element to be as heavy as possible. In other words, have large Z, because that means you have higher concentration of electrons in the atom. So this is a reason why germanium would have a bigger absorption cross-section than silicon, and this is also a reason why people are interested in cadmium telluride, because both cadmium and tellurium are pretty heavy. And later on, you will see that some rare earths are also advantageous because they have large Z. And then on the horizontal row, I've highlighted the electron mutile product and the hole mutile products. And of course, if you can read the fine prints, you'll see the individual electron mobility, the hole mobility, and so on. And what you find that for silicon and germanium, this mutile product is kind of called the figure of merit for this kind of device. And it's typically of the order of one. But the next competitor, like cadmium telluride, you have to read the fine prints, then it's of the order 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. So it's down by three orders of magnitude. Okay. Of course, in this case, it's well known. The reason is cadmium telluride is a direct band gap material. So radiative recombination is much faster than in the indirect band gap materials, typically by three orders of magnitude. So you can explain the difference simply in terms of the band structure. So another, so you can see that we are interested in things like cadmium telluride. The other thing that we are interested in is in gadolinium. So you can ask why, what's so special about gadolinium? Well, it turns out that to detect neutrons are even more difficult than gamma rays, because neutrons, you'll find that they don't interact, since it's neutral, it don't interact very strongly with electrons. And a lot of the times, the neutrons that are produced are so-called thermal neutrons. In other words, they don't even have a lot of kinetic energy. On the other hand, neutrons are extremely important if you work with nuclear reactors. So right now, basically, they have detectors, but those detectors are based on helium, helium-3. So it would be nice to have a solid-state detector for neutron. And then in this case, you ask, well, obviously, I would like to have some iron that has a large absorption cross-section for neutron. And you find that gadolinium is one of them, because gadolinium actually has these, according to some of my nuclear physics friends, it has the largest absorption cross-section for thermal neutron. And then after it absorbs this thermal neutron, it will emit a 72 keV electron. Okay. Well, so this will suggest that maybe one should consider semiconductors doped with gadolinium as a candidate for some solid-state neutron detector. Okay. Of course, if you dope gadolinium into a 2-6 semiconductor, you know that it will when it replaces the say the cation, the group 2 cation, it will be a donor. On the other hand, if you dope it into a 3-5 semiconductor like gallium arsenide, and if you replace the gallium, it is something called the isoelectronic center. So its behavior will be somewhat different as an impurity. So now what is our goal and approach? So obviously you would like to examine and find new semiconductors which can be used as room temperature detectors, okay, for X-ray, gamma ray, maybe even neutrons. And so first thing is you have to develop a fast way to fabricate sample, because in this case, basically the phase space is almost infinite. Any semiconductor in principle can work. So you'll find that one thing we propose is, at Berkeley is to use a parallel processing approach to mix samples. If you go to the basement, I think here Dr. Miatorovsky, he grows one single crystal at a time. It takes him maybe a week or more to grow one single crystal. This is not fast enough to examine all the possible candidates. So what we need is to grow, as you will see, over 100 samples in one batch. And of course, in this case, we don't want to just do it blindly. So hopefully we will use theoretical modeling to guide the experiment. So before we even grow certain sample, we will look at the band structure and say, well, forget about this thing. This thing, the band gap is too small, or this thing, the band gap is too large. So the experimental approach is something called the combinatorial material fabrication approach. And then after you fabricate the sample, of course, you have to find out exactly also what you have, what you make. Okay, so you also have to use a lot of characterization processes that can be very fast. You know, you have to be able to do X-ray microprobes, electron microscopy, diffraction, Rutherford scattering, optical measurement, mobility measurement, and so on. Okay, luckily now I'm not an experimentalist. I don't have to worry about all this fancy equipment. Well, in this case, what is exactly the combinatorial material fabrication? Okay, so I point out that the traditional fabrication technique, you may call it a serial approach, okay, because we are all familiar with computer processing. There's things called serial input, there's parallel input. In the case of material process, we can say, can there be a parallel processing technology, where we can fabricate hundreds of samples at the same time in one batch, rather than do it one at a time? Well, it turns out that first, people in the drug discovery, okay, the pharmaceutical company have been doing this kind of approach for many years, because if you want to do something that is try and error, you better have an approach which can process many material in a very fast way. So the drug company developed this kind of combinatorial approach. And Peter Schultz, who used to be a professor in the chemistry department, was the first one to propose to use the same approach to discover new materials. This was proposed during the heyday of the high-TC superconductors, where everything seemed to be a new high-TC superconductor. So he proposed that maybe we use this combinatorial approach, then we can get to room temperature much faster. So the cut a long story short, this is basically the idea. It's very simple in the sense that, okay, you need something, say, typically a reaction chamber. You need a substrate. And let's say, in this case, the idea is to use a laser beam to ablate the sample. So in this case, you can ablate a number of targets. Let's say you want to make gallium aluminum arsenide alloy, then you need three targets. If you want to introduce manganese, put in four targets. And then for every target, then you basically deposit your material on the substrate, but you also make mass to separate your substrate into different areas so that every area will have a slightly different material composition or processing. And so by using basically a set of this so-called quaternary mass to define the target area on the substrate, you can make many samples in one run. Basically, cool down your sample chamber, vacuum it out, and so on. And in one processing, you can make a 100 samples. So this is, of course, involve some rather expensive equipment. So this is just show you a lot of stainless steel is involved here. So this is an example of a quaternary mass where you have four mass. You see everything is divided into see, so four parts here, and then you can easily use theory of permutation combination to show that this format will give you 256 samples, basically. So this shows you the serial approach, where nowadays we can grow a big single crystal of silicon that is as big as a human being. And then here you have this combinatorial approach, which in this case will give you something of the order of over 200 samples in one batch. Of course, each sample is only a couple of millimeter in size, okay? So now let's move on to the theoretical part, which I'm involved. So our goal now is to use the first principle calculation as far as possible to calculate everything we need to know in order to arrive at the mu tau product. So for example, we would like to get the band structure, we would like to get the phonon spectra, we would like to get the electron-phonon interaction, and then after, and also get the defects, their properties, how they affect the band structure and the mobility and so on. And then we can finally arrive at the carrier mobility and also calculate the lifetime. So we'll be able to get the mu tau product. Okay. So obviously we have not yet reached there. Some of the check mark shows the milestone we have reached, and these are some of the things we still need to work on. Okay. Well, the nice thing about doing computation these days is, of course, there's been a lot of effort going into solid-state physics to do this kind of computation. So there are now very efficient codes for doing this kind of calculation. You can basically choose and pick the approach you want. You can choose empirical techniques, like the empirical pseudopotential technique, which is very fast. It can be accurate because you use parameters which fits the experiment. But on the other hand, you will have problem with things like D and F electrons, which are quite localized, and so pseudopotentials are not good approximations. And of course, the worst part is that you rely on your experimentalist friends to give you the input. So what we hope is that we can bypass the experimentalist, or we will be one step ahead of the experimentalist, so we will be able to tell them what to look for. So in this case, we need first principle or ab initio calculation. So that's, again, no problem. As a matter of fact, I think at the APS meeting, there was a special session to commemorate the history of the discovery of this, something called the density functional theory. Of course, Walter Kong got the Nobel Prize for this work. So in this case, what you don't need experimental input, and you just need to know the atomic numbers, Z, and you can work with D electron, F electrons. But of course, in this case, you need a little bit more powerful computers to do that. But computers are cheap these days, so that's not a major drawback. Probably the major drawback is this approach called the local density approximation, or LDA, is well known to underestimate the band gap. Okay, it's good for predicting the ground state properties, but for excited state property like the band gap, then you find that it somehow always underestimate the band gap. But of course, there's a way to fix that. There's something called a GW approximation, which can fix this problem, but it will require a lot more computer time. You need a supercomputer to do it, this kind of calculation. So it would mean that if you do narrow down your candidates to something, maybe one particular candidate, you say it seemed to work, but you want to know more precisely its band gap, then what you can do is then use a supercomputer to do a GW calculation to get the band gap more exactly. So that is a minor sort of shortcoming. It's not fatal. So I now move on to talk about the first experimental result, which involves zinc telluride. And in this case, you can see that it's not the same as cadmium telluride, but on the other hand, has tellurium. As a matter of fact, people have tried to make now detectors based on zinc cadmium telluride. Sometimes you heard this term CZT, which is abbreviation of cadmium zinc telluride. And of course, in this case, the alloy has the advantage in that you can put in the cadmium to give you the large Z, and then you put in the zinc to open up the band gap. So cadmium telluride may have a band gap of only roughly 1.5 EV. By putting in enough zinc, you can try to open it up. So it will work at room temperature. So in this case, what we do is, or at least the experimentalists in the project, it was to grow the sample at 10 to the minus 7 torr. They use a pulse laser to ablate the zinc telluride or the cadmium gadolinium target. And then afterwards, they improve the sample quality by annealing it in nitrogen. And so these are some examples of samples they grew. You'll find that when they start out, they already have a little bit of deficiency of tellurium. This is easily understandable, mainly because tellurium is more volatile. So you expect that there will be more tellurium in floating around in the chamber rather than on the substrate. But of course, if you want to fix that, you can try to develop a processing technique where you will be in the presence of some overpressure of tellurium that will solve this problem. But the main thing is, as you put gadolinium into it, so you find that the trend is rather strange in the sense that when you put in the gadolinium, you find that actually it looks like tellurium actually disappear first, and then it gradually come back, and then finally you found that at high enough gadolinium concentration, then the tellurium now do not have a deficiency. And finally, you are starting to substitute for the zinc. Okay, so the zinc decreases. So the substitution of zinc by gadolinium is not a very simple, straightforward process. Okay, and if you, these are of course the samples, and then you look at the X-ray, you can tell what is the crystal structure. You can show that they are basically still zinc blend structure. You can also look carefully and show that there's some sort of a shift in the X-ray when you go to higher gadolinium concentration. For low gadolinium concentration, okay, so you find that the peaks start shifting to lower angle. Okay, so that actually says that the lattice constant decreases, and then finally a high concentration is seem to remain constant. So that's the first result that sounds very weird. The reason is because if you look at the ionic radius, then you realize gadolinium is a big fat atom. It's trying to replace this slim zinc atom. And at first, what happens seems to be that actually the lattice constant contract rather than expand. Okay, so that's a little bit strange, unexpected. And then, of course, you can also look at the band gap and see what happens. And what you find is that, well, since, as I told you, gadolinium is a donor when it substitutes for zinc. So it looks like, in this case, of course, what we are doing is some sort of a modulator transmission experiment. And then the peak gives us the position of some sort of energy optical gap. And what you find is that for low concentration, the gap doesn't seem to change. And then at high concentration, the gap shows some sort of blue shift, okay? So the result is summarized in this curve. On one hand, you see the lattice constant decrease and finally stabilize. Where the lattice constant is changing, the gap is not changing. When the lattice constant remains constant, suddenly the gap shoots up. So the result seems to be counterintuitive, because you expect that first happen is that the gadolinium is going to expand the lattice and is going to dope the sample, so produce donors, and so you will expect that there will be some shift of the band gap due to the doping.
Is zinc telluride magnetic?
Well, in this case, we did not make any magnetic measurement on this sample. So we don't know whether it is magnetic or not. Okay. Well, no, we are talking about after you dope it with gadolinium. Okay. Well, the only reason is because this project, you can see, has nothing to do with magnetism. So obviously, you cannot tell the funding agency that you're going to buy a squid magnetometer also, right? So what we have to do, the experimenters are doing, is basically give the sample to people like Francis Hellman, who's interested in magnetism, to do the magnetic measurement, okay? So basically, what we are proposing is that the gadolinium is basically very large compared to the zinc. So it will induce a lot of local strain. So the crystal want to relax the strain. And the way it can do it is by creating defects, especially things like vacancies, which can then reduce the lattice constant. So I flew here on Southwest. I suspect that many of you also have flew on Southwest. And on Southwest, you don't have reserved seats. So everyone want to sit either in the window or on the aisle, always leaving the middle seat empty until, of course, finally someone will come and sit in the middle. So imagine that you have a guy who's 300 pounds is now sitting in, let's say, the aisle seat. Obviously, nobody wants to sit next to him. So he would have created his own vacancy, right? So what we do is do a calculation, okay? So do a density functional theory. We use something called the linearized augmented plane wave method. There's actually software you can buy called VN2K from the Vienna group, which will implement all this calculation for you. Of course, since we are talking about things like D and F electrons, so we need to worry about the exchange and the correlation. So we use also something called the GGA, the generalized gradient approximation of the density functional theory. And of course, when you talk about the F electron, you have to worry about the U, which is basically the Coulomb repulsion, and then there's the exchange interaction called J. And of course, we have to construct some sort of a supercell to do the calculation, mainly because later on, we need to put in the impurity. Of course, if you don't work with impurity, you don't need to worry about the using a supercell. But later on, we are going to add gadolinium to it. So this is first thing we can do, is we can calculate the gadolinium doped zinc telluride with various forms of point defects. Okay, so this is the defect-free case, or the intrinsic one. You can calculate the band gap, and you look at the band gap right away, you see, wait, the band gap is too small for zinc telluride. Okay, of course, this is the problem of the LDA. But we can always use something called the scissor operator to fix that. You see, before I became a theorist, I always wonder what is the scissor operator. Then I thought the theorist has discovered some profound physics to solve that problem. Basically, I discover what they do is they say, oh, this is a problem we can fix by arbitrarily shifting this gap to agree with the experiment. So they call, instead of saying that we cheated by shifting the gap, they call this, give it a very high sounding name, the scissor operator, okay. In the other thing we did, of course, was to calculate the material with various intrinsic defects, like anthracite defects, interstitial zinc, zinc vacancy, tellurium vacancy, and then later on we have substitutional gadolinium. And I think this shows you that suppose we have a supercell as this volume, and then when you put in the different defects, if you put in just substitutional gadolinium, you see that indeed the lattice expands. But on the other hand, if you just put in the vacancies, of course it shrinks. So I try to you show them in different color. The red one means you reduce the lattice constant, and the other one you increase the lattice constant. Okay. And then, of course, in principle, you can also calculate the band gap. And some of this, you'll find that it is metallic mainly because the concentration we are using quite often is extremely high because we have a rather small supercell. So even you put in one defect, then it's like one in 16. Then this is, of course, a huge defect concentration. So in this case, we know that with the undoped zinc telluride sample, already it has a deficiencies in tellurium. So it already has some sort of vacancies in it already. Or, of course, if you have an interstitial zinc, it will produce the same effect. You will have more zinc than tellurium. Or zinc anthracite defects will also work. Now we do the complex calculation. So in this case, we again said, let's put in now, instead of just one isolated point defect, we put in now some complex, which contains two defects. Since gadolinium, for example, when it substitutes zinc, it would like to relax maybe the lattice strain by creating a vacancy at the same time. And let's see whether it works. So you can see that if you put this pair in, it still expands. But on the other hand, if you put in a tellurium vacancy, then it works. Actually, the one that works best in shrinking the lattice is when gadolinium replaces the tellurium, and you also have a vacancy of tellurium. You can see that it can reduce the lattice constant by a huge amount. Okay. So what we feel is happening in the samples, the different samples, that would explain the stoichiometry and also explain the reduction of the lattice constant is that when you start putting in the gadolinium, you introduce a lot of this gadolinium substitutional and vacancy defect pair. And then later on, when you start putting in more gadolinium, you start seeing you get to substitute also the zinc. So you get both defect complexes appearing. And then finally, you start finding that now the tellurium now is those stoichiometric. And so the gadolinium is forced to substitute only the zinc. And then you find that the complex, which can explain this result, are shown there. So this also shows you some of the nice thing you can do as a theorist. You can generate beautiful looking graphics. You can put in any color you want. So here it shows the case where you have this A is basically the unrelaxed gadolinium replacing the tellurium. So this is your gadolinium, okay? And then what happened is that after you allow the lattice to relax, you find that this particular atom will basically be removed and you'll create a vacancy. And what happened is that, of course, the gadolinium also will now move a little bit more to take advantage of the more additional space available to it because of the creation of this vacancy. So you can see that this atom moved out of the way. Okay, this allows the gadolinium, okay, to fit in. Okay, so this is shows at least the result seems to work. So this is my first slide to wake you up in case I know the time. I know it's kind of late in the afternoon. So if you feel drowsy, so I show you some pictures I took when I was in Tibet. So I call this the 7 days in Tibet, in contrast to the 7 years in Tibet. Okay. Here, of course, is this world-famous building, a beautiful example of architecture. And here are some life of the common Tibetan people, some children in the traditional dress. Well, what happens is that they, of course, come around and want you to take picture of them. And then, of course, they will charge you money for taking pictures. But instead of giving them money, we said, we have some fruits that we got with our lunchbox. So we gave them the fruit instead because it's better for them to eat the fruit. And of course, this kind of fresh fruit is very expensive in Tibet. And so you can see that they're very happy, immediately munch on the fruit. Okay. And then this is also another very interesting picture. In Tibet, there's a lot of pool tables. They're all outdoors. I don't quite understand why. And here you'll see that I think some of them are bars, and so they have two pool tables. And here, I guess during the bright daylight, business is not so good. So this mother is teaching the children how to play pool. And finally, this, anyone know what is going on here? Well, these are three pilgrims. What they are doing is they're taking a pilgrimage to this building. So every Tibetan Buddhist is supposed to take a pilgrimage in their lifetime to Lhasa. And the way you have to do it, of course, Muslims do it and so on. And Christian also takes pilgrimage, especially in the Middle Ages. If you do something wrong, you have to take a pilgrimage to Rome to get the forgiveness from the Pope. No, that's for those of you who are opera fans, of course, that's the basis of this famous Wagner opera, Tannhäuser. So here, these are three Tibetan pilgrims on their way to Lhasa. We pass them on the highway. This is a kind of a highway. However, this what is unique about the Tibetan pilgrim is that you can see that one is walking, but in the few steps, he will be like this guy. He will have to kneel. Not only kneel and say his prayer, he has to prostrate himself completely on the ground. Okay, so I know that pilgrims going to Mecca, they may have to kneel on their prayer mat facing Mecca and so on. But most people, religion require that you just kneel, but not in Tibetan Buddhism. You have to pray by posturally completely lying on the ground. And also, in order to enter the nirvana, you have to do this 100,000 times in your lifetime. Okay. Of course, our Tibetan guide told us that typically these people, they will take something like 3 to 5 years to complete this journey. As far as I know, India, where Buddhism originated, you don't have to do that. In China, of course, we have also other sects of Buddhism, and my mother is a Buddhist, and my mother doesn't do that. Okay. So now, if you wake up already, we can now move on to the next physics topic about ferromagnetism in gallium nitride doped with gadolinium. In this case, we didn't do the experiment. Actually, the experiment was reported in the literature by groups in Japan, by the German group. And what they have basically found is that they can get TC, room temperature TC. So for those of you who are trying to look for ferromagnetism at room temperature, you can see that you can do that with gadolinium doped gallium nitride. Although Thomas Dieter once predicted that you can get room temperature ferromagnetism by putting manganese into gallium nitride. But as far as I know, no one has succeeded at reaching room temperature with manganese, but you can do it with gadolinium, okay? So in this case, we were quite intrigued by what the German group had found. Not only they found that you can get room temperature TC, but they also found a very large enhancement in the magnetic moment. They call this colossal magnetic moment. But the thing also is very interesting to us is that they found that the magnetic moment per gadolinium is enhanced, increases when you have poorer samples. Usually we know that if you have a bad sample, the effect goes away. But this is the case where the worse the sample, the effect is stronger. So they basically implant the gadolinium into their gallium nitride. And don't even anneal it. So we all know in that case, you basically amorphize the gallium nitride. And they found that the enhancement of the magnetic moment is the largest in those samples. So it indicates that some defect, however, is involved. And somehow the defect works together with the gadolinium to produce the ferromagnetism. So since we have studied in zinc telluride, how get by putting in gadolinium, you introduce an intrinsic defect. So we decided to look at this problem. That's the advantage of being a theorist. We can just sit on the computer, replace the zinc telluride with gallium nitride. Voila, we go. We don't have to buy another reactor. We don't have to worry about the equipment. So in this case, what we ask is then, what would happen to the magnetic moment if we just put in gadolinium? Okay, so you just realize that, of course, gadolinium has 4F electrons, which can be, of course, due to Hund's rule, they are completely polarized, so that gives you something like 7 Bohr magnetons. There is a D electron, which is involved in the bonding, so that's why when you substitute gallium, gadolinium basically is valence-free and so on. So we repeat the calculation, except we use now a spin-polarized density functional theory and so on. So our paper actually appeared only last month. So here, what is a summary of what we found. What we found is that if you take gallium nitride, and of course, pure gallium nitride is not ferromagnetic. If you put in gadolinium into it and don't allow any defects, of course, it's also not ferromagnetic. It's just paramagnetic. Now you say, all right, let me introduce some vacancy. So we say, all right, let's put in some nitrogen vacancy. We found that no change. It remains paramagnetic. However, if we put in a gallium vacancy, suddenly find that it is very strongly ferromagnetic. Actually, the total magnetic moment we get is basically 7 Bohr magnetons from the gadolinium and 3 from this gallium vacancy, showing that the holes, which are basically generated, are completely polarized. And then, of course, if you look at the valence band for the one spin compared to the other spin, you find that indeed the top of the valence band is completely polarized, 100% polarized. Okay. So what is going on? Okay. Well, in this case, what we found is that actually there is a very strong spin polarization just in the gallium vacancy. Okay, so this is after we sort of had a paper accepted at the APS meeting. I met Professor Sang from Buffalo and found out that he's actually working on something similar to us, but it's different in the sense that he's looking at gallium nitride. However, he's looking at intrinsic defect, no gadolinium, just defect. And what he found is that if you introduce gallium vacancies, then the free holes will be completely polarized. Okay. And his explanation is that, okay, this again shows you the spin polarized density of states. This is from his picture. So here he is showing just the valence band. And you can see that again, the top of the valence band completely polarized. And you can count that there will be exactly 3 bands there. And their argument is, in this case, when you create a gallium vacancy, okay, then basically the holes derive its wave function from the nitrogen. And in this case, there is lattice relaxation of the surrounding nitrogen around the gallium vacancy. And so the electron wave functions become extremely polarized, extremely localized. And it's this localization then caused the some sort of a Hund's rule to apply here. So the holes are basically completely polarized. And I have to give them credit for the guts to go ahead and do this calculation, because if you know something about gallium nitride, you will say that this calculation is just meaningless, because it's well known that it's difficult to grow P-type gallium nitride, because it's very difficult to introduce holes. So people have done a formation energy to, like Chris Vandervoort, to show that gallium vacancy will be unstable unless in the presence of a lot of electron donors and so on. So to assume that you have a sample which has gallium vacancy producing free holes is ridiculous, you know. Can never be done experimentally, okay? It's basically a theoretical exercise. But luckily, independently, okay, this is what they have calculated. What they show is that it not only works for gallium nitride, it also works for boron nitride. You can see that the magnetic moment, the local moment, exactly free Bohr magneton, exactly like what we found. And you can even calculate the so-called the polarization energy. Basically, you calculate the total energy for the spin-up electron and for the spin-down electron. And then you find that the ferromagnetic state is favored by this amount of energy. And you can see that this is of the order of hundreds of milli-electron, and that's why it's room temperature TC. So in this case, when we compare our number to this, you can see that after you put in the gadolinium, you basically add the 7 Bohr magneton due to the gadolinium, and you find that this energy is basically in the same ballpark for gallium nitride, okay? So what we basically have done is to show that their result makes sense, provided, of course, you can stabilize those gallium vacancy. And if you want to stabilize a gallium vacancy, the best thing to do is put in the gadolinium, because when you put in the gadolinium, this big fat atom basically produces a string and stabilizes the vacancy. And then on top of that, you also pick up the magnetic moment from the gadolinium. Well, of course, you say that, well, you have only shown that you get 10 Bohr magneton per gadolinium. How you explain the experimental result, you can end up with 4,000 Bohr magneton. Well, that is still somewhat controversial because this number is so large. I don't think any simple-minded theory could explain that. So this is still something to be worked on. Okay. Any question at this point before I think my time is getting tight? I better move on to my last topic, okay. So this is my next slide, which will hopefully enrich your life. And this is copper in cadmium telluride. Now, you might have heard that the stock market is going down. A lot of companies are losing money and so on, okay. But not if you are investing in cadmium telluride. Okay, so there's huge money to be made in cadmium telluride. It has generated interest now as a thin film solar cell material. There's a company called First Solar, which is listed, of course, on the stock market, stock exchange. The symbol is FSLR. And it went from $54 to $274 as of something like, maybe 2 days ago when I before I left. And all this in 1 year, a factor of five in just 1 year, okay? And it's still going up. Actually, I think before the day I left, I found that it's now gone up to over $280, okay? So here is the website, and it tells you something very important. It says, cadmium telluride is a semiconductor made by transforming cadmium and tellurium from their elemental forms into a stable semiconductor. The cadmium in First Solar's cadmium telluride is derived from zinc smelting waste. So this upcycling of cadmium into safe, cost-effective solar energy not only reduces the toxic effect of fossil fuel generation, but prevents potentially dangerous elemental cadmium from entering the environment. So this is the green technology, okay? So if you are not convinced that the money to be made in green technology, you better change your mind, because in Silicon Valley, there are a lot of venture capitalists who have tons of money that they want to put into green technologies like this, obviously. So since my time is kind of a little bit short, so I and also this work is more or less in progress, I maybe tell you the major finding in the experimental work. The major finding in this experimental work is that they found that cadmium telluride can have rather high hole mobility. Well, in this case, the film the experimentalists made, they achieve a mobility of the order 150 centimeters squared per volt second. And if you go and look at the table that I showed you earlier, you'll find that it lists the hole mobility of about single crystal as 100. So after putting in something of the order of 10 to the 20th copper, making the sample P-type, they found that the hole mobility is basically as high as the bulk single crystal, which is, of course, basically counterintuitive. Again, we've been taught in solid-state physics that when you put in defects, they add additional scattering to your carrier. So in this case, you expect that the mobility to go down. But somehow, in case of copper, it doesn't do that. So what we have found is that, well, if you calculate the band structure of cadmium telluride, though, with copper, okay, we found basically two effects. One is that the band gap, okay, actually is reduced, okay? So I try to show that this, again, the absolute value is not right, but the relative value is correct. The band gap actually shrinks. But that is nothing new. You say that, wow, what you have done is the copper introduced the D levels. The D levels basically hybridize with the valence band, and it pushes up the valence band, and so the band gap is reduced. You find the same thing happening with the chalcopyrite materials and so on. And then the other thing is it reduces the spin orbit coupling. That's, again, you said reasonable, because cadmium, tellurium, they're both very heavy. Large Z material have large spin orbit coupling. And so when you put it in copper, which has much smaller spin orbit coupling, then you find the spin orbit coupling is reduced. And of course, this kind of a change in the band structure affects the effective mass. So what we found is that indeed, you can reduce the effective mass depending on the direction. After all, the whole basic dispersion is anisotropic. And so in this case, you find that the reduction is largest along the 110 direction, which is basically in the plane of the films. So that shows you that, well, copper potentially can have an effect on the mobility by changing the effective mass. Of course, we still have to figure out what's happened to the electron or the whole phonon scattering. So again, in this case, we found that, well, the trends predict that when you replace cadmium with copper, you're going to increase the phonon frequency. And at room temperature, the scattering is basically dominated by the whole LO phonon scattering. So if you can show that the phonon energy increases, then it will decrease the phonon scattering. And since this is exponential factor, so the effect can be rather large. So this is the thing that we are still working on, trying to figure out how to calculate the phonon energy in the presence of this kind of defect. So hopefully, when we finish that, we will work on your problem of oxygen in the cadmium telluride. Okay. So here is our conclusion. Okay. The thing I want to leave you is that this search we start out turns out to be quite exciting, and it's going to be a long journey. So if I may, I'd like to quote from this poem, Ithaca, by Konstanty Kavafi, who is a Greek poet. He said, when you set out on the road to Ithaca, it may not rhyme very well, mainly because it's translated from Greek. Pray that the journey is long, full of adventure, full of knowledge. Of course, this Ithaca is not the Ithaca in upstate New York. This is the island of Ithaca, you know, in Homer's Odyssey. So with this quotation from this lovely poem, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Yes.
Question to the first part. Uh-huh. We have very contradicting requirements for the material. Low, small gap, large gap, and so clearly there is no material that can fit into that category. Would just simple nanosized bolometer do the job?
Why you say bolometer? Usually bolometer means you meet, use it to measure heat.
Absorb all mega electron volt of the energy and see for the spike and temperature. We can have it very, very sensitive nowadays.
But remember, in this case, to absorb the particle, let's say you have something which is of the order of a couple of centimeters size.
Use silicon for that. Heavy materials.
Okay. So still, the heavy material is probably, let's say, a centimeter cube. Okay. So now the question is that if you put in the energy of 1 million electron volt, would you be able to raise the temperature enough at room temperature to measure this rise in temperature? Of course, at a very low temperature, I agree, because we all know that heat capacity goes like T cubed. So at low temperature, you can completely quench the phonon part. So you will be in the presence of zero background. And then this heat will immediately can be detected. But you have to operate at room temperature, remember. Okay. Okay, so
you mentioned that ferromagnetite would become ferromagnetic if we actually introduce introduce holes there, holes there. But on the other hand, you know, we kind of got used to the fact that all properties of materials are defined by symmetry. So symmetry of gallium nitride is the same as symmetry of gallium arsenide. It is very easy to introduce holes into gallium arsenide, but nevertheless, if you simply introduce holes there and it's not a magnetic doping like manganese, you wouldn't see any ferromagnetism in gallium arsenide. Despite, you know, you would expect that the symmetry is the same. It could be maybe even 100 times smaller, you know, but it should be something, but you don't see it.
Yes.
How would you explain that?
Okay. The first thing is actually in this case, the symmetry turns out to be not that important. Mainly because you mentioned that gallium nitride has the same symmetry as gallium arsenide is not quite exactly correct, because we know that gallium nitride has a wolfside structure, which is different from the zinc blend structure. But on the other hand, you also know that it depends on how you deposit the gallium nitride on some substrate. If you deposit on silicon carbide, then you can make zinc blend. So in this case, we do actually investigate the effect of symmetry by doing that's the advantage of the theory. We basically repeat the calculation for both wolfside structure and zinc blend structure and found that you find the same kind of ferromagnetism. Maybe the total energy difference, the delta E, is slightly different. You know, instead of, say, 0.7 eV, you get 0.5 eV kind of. So as far as the crystal structure is concerned, we find that this is not very important. And you can explain that by saying that, well, what is basically the physics here? The physics here is the fact that when you introduce the gallium vacancy, actually I would refer you to read this paper of Professor Zhang. I could have quoted more figures from his paper, but since that's his work, he has also shown how the electron wave function show the collection. They kind of localize around this vacancy cage made from the nitrogen. And so in this case, the secret is not so much you have, say, arsenic, but rather how localized would be the electron in this case when you have this vacancy. So his conclusion is that as long as you have nitrogen, whether you have gallium or whether you have boron or whether you have aluminum, that is not important. Okay. So we have basically reproduced it without showing that indeed, if we repeat our calculation for gallium arsenide, even you put in gadolinium into it, it's not ferromagnetic.
So it's nitrogen vacancy that is important.
With gadolinium. Aluminum nitride with gadolinium doping is not ferromagnetic as well.
We have not tried it for aluminum nitride doped with gallium.
Experimentally.
That's interesting because Professor Zhang's group, they have done it for boron nitride.
Now,
Yeah, they did not show aluminum. Okay, of course, I was thinking that maybe they did not bother to show everything they've done. So they just showed it for boron and gallium. It's interesting for us to try it. Well, one thing you can see is that we are fighting the battle on several fronts, so we can't not. And also, this is something that you do it as a hobby. You cannot tell the funding agency. Actually, our funding agency is DOE, and let me see the. I have the give you the last slide shows the acknowledgement. She thanked all the people who did all the work. But what the contract you can see that is from the special division in DOE, which is called NNSA, which really stands for some nuclear energy disarmament agency. Okay, so in this case, they are not interested in magnetism or spintronics or whatever. So we have to kind of tell them ignore this work on the ferromagnetism. Okay, so we have not really played around with all the possible hosts yet. But it's the fact that you mentioned that aluminum nitride is not ferromagnetic, it would be worthwhile for us to go back and to see whether theoretically we also get the same result. Okay, because if that's the case, it will be interesting. It will show that maybe Professor Zhang's calculation is not quite complete. Okay. Yes.
I don't know if this plays a role for the perfect detector that you're trying to develop, but the commercial ones replacing silicon and germanium solid-state detectors. They're lithium drifted.
That's right. Silicon is lithium drifted. Yeah.
Well, there's some for germanium too. What's the lithium doing, and is that of any relevance here?
I have studied that once. Okay, I think it has something to do with the compensation of some of the intrinsic defects in silicon. So to increase the
unless you have ultra pure germanium. Lithium, what's it called, iron pairs, and simply takes it out of circulation. But you have to keep it at low
temperatures,
otherwise
the
lithium drips. Mm-hmm. So if you make it ultra pure, as Eugene Haller does, you can operate at room temperature. And you don't need it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's a secondary
sort of.
Yes. It's your either combinatorial fabrication, you show it many pixels. How big is it?
It's about 2 by 2 millimeters square.
So that's much smaller than the centimeter.
Oh, yes. This is called discovery. It's just like the drug company. Once you identify this as a potential candidate, obviously there's still a lot of work to do to develop it into a product. But in this case, at least you know that you should concentrate your effort on this particular composition and not waste your time on a lot of other compositions which do not work. As a matter of fact, Peter Schultz just proposed this idea, people would say, well, how to know that this thing is going to work? You will just discover a lot of material which do not work, which are not high TC superconductor. Then he said, yes, so these are negative results. He said, that's true, but at least I would discover the negative results 100 times faster than you would be doing with your single processing technique.
I just wonder if you have looked at the doping of heavy rare earths like terbium into the gallium nitride, and can you comment whether you also spectromagnetism?
Well, as you can see, for this particular program, our justification for looking at gadolinium is not that it's produced ferromagnetism. It's because it has large neutron absorption cross section. So the answer to your question is that in principle, we can certainly do it very easily theoretically, but we have to do it sort of below the radar screen. Okay. So, I told my postdoc, you can work on this in the evening and on weekends, because then in that case, you say you're doing it on your own time. Okay. But of course, he only works in the evening. Most theorists, they love to work in the evening only. So.
there are no more questions. Let's thank Professor Yu for a wonderful.
Okay.